Hello, I'm Detlef Schlich, visual artist, musician and host of Artitude, West Cork's art, culture and philosophy podcast. Artitude explores art, culture, technology, music and the creative process not only through interviews but through deeper reflections on what it means to create, to listen, to remember and to stay human in a rapidly changing world. So join us on every platform.
Artitude, never so close again. That was too close.
My youngest, she's gotten into like old 2000s like kid sitcoms, and then she'll be like, what's this person look like now? And I'll be like, well, they're 35, here's what they look like, you know.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
All right, here we are back again, another episode, and I am so glad to have you here with me. I appreciate you coming back by. And if this is the first time you've checked out Story and Craft, well, doggone it, thank you for checking in. Today we're getting into the weeds, getting into how the sausage is made when it comes to creating television, speaking with producer and writer Joel Church Cooper. He has collaborated with the likes of Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg on the show Future Man, also Undateable. He has written and created Brockmire with the great Hank Azaria. Right now, though, he created and is a writer on the show Going Dutch on Fox with Dennis Leary. It is a great conversation where we get a little behind-the-curtain look at what goes into making TV and film. It's a very cool conversation again. And, of course, I always ask a little favor. If you would, make sure to follow Story and Craft on whatever podcast app you prefer. Also, check out the show at storyandcraftpod.com. And we're getting into the whole Substack thing, and you may not even be on Substack. You may be going, you know, I don't need another social media channel. But this is actually kind of cool. It's a great way to follow the show. You get an email every time a new episode rolls out. And, of course, I'm a big supporter of independent media, and Substack is really kind of part of what's going on right now in the world of independent media. Just head to storyandcraft.substack.com. All right, so let's get into it. We're talking comedy, we're talking TV, and we're going Dutch because it's Joel Church Cooper Day right here on Story and Craft. So where are you located right now?
I live in Glendale.
Okay, so still in the L.A. area.
Yeah.
Are you originally an L.A. kid, or are you...
Yeah, I'm from Northern California. I was born in Sacramento, and then I went to high school in Santa Cruz.
Naturally, I have to ask, are you into surfing at all, by any chance?
Too big. I'm about 6'4", 270 for surfing. Santa Cruz, mostly fun, chill vibes. That's what I enjoyed about it. And I've lived in California, you know... I went to school in UC Santa Barbara, so I've lived in California my whole life.
Very good. Very, yeah, because I seem to remember Santa Cruz being a real big surf spot. I can't remember the...
It's a very big surf spot, for sure. I mean, I knew lots of kids in my class who were surfers. I just was never really taken by it.
I used to live in Encinitas, in North County, San Diego, and I would meet people like, oh yeah, my teachers are totally cool. If the breaks were really good, you know, I could just, you know, not go to class that day or something, or show up late and the teacher would just understand, you know, like much more understanding than my teachers in Texas would have been, you know, but
I went to school in Santa Barbara. It was definitely like going to the beach. Like if it was a Friday and the weather was good, it was just an expectation that, you know, you wouldn't go to class.
Did you go to college out that way, or did you go to college? Or
yeah, I went to college at UC Santa Barbara, and I was a film studies major there. And then I got a job as an assistant right out of college on a sitcom, and so I joined the industry very soon after.
So the whole creative thing, that thing kicked off early for you. So you knew in like high school, I guess, that this is what you wanted to do, or?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I was like classic movie nerd kid. You know, this was the late 80s, early 90s when movies were at the center of culture, unlike now, and TV was kind of junk. And I watched a crap ton of TV, don't get me wrong, but movies were the special thing, and my dad liked to go to the movies, and so... We would go you know, see at least a movie a weekend, sometimes two. He would call it a double bill. We would find, you know, two movies that were playing, you know, where one ended, we could walk into the other one. And
okay, so you did that also.
I did that too. And then we would like do things of like, you know, we would come in together and then we would like go to this, we would like take off our jackets and grab a popcorn and then like go in separately to the second movie kind of thing to like, you know. So, and then when I was getting older, it was right when video stores were king, and I remember Hollywood Video had a deal where you could do 10 old movies for $10 for 10 days. So really? I just started going down.
I had no idea they did that.
I think that was their like big, move to like horn in on Blockbuster. And so I just would go down like the lists of 100 best movies, 100 best comedies, Ebert, Leonard Maltin, you know. And then I started going through directors, filmographies. And then when I was older in high school, I got a job at a video, like the local cool video store in Santa Cruz. So I got free rentals and I could, you know, and they had all these foreign movies and all the independent movies. So by the time I went to school, I essentially had a film school education. By the time I went to film school,
I could see where that's completely possible, you know, because, you know, especially, you know, you're a Gen X kid also, you know, late 80s, early 90s, you remember all that. And it was like Friday nights were kind of an event, you know, it's sort of a cliche or a trope, you know, Blockbuster and get a pizza, but that was kind of a thing. When they moved to DVD, that was cool. I remember the VHS. I remember, do you remember those video discs? I don't know why that thought just popped in my mind. Not DVD, but the big, they look like the size of an album.
Laser disc.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got yeah. It. My video store, I was there. So I worked at a video store in college too. So I was really, somewhat the stereotypical at the time sort of film nerd, but you know, free rentals, you can't, the ultimate perk. And so in high school, we switched over to DVD and I was like young and plugged in. So I was like telling the owner of the store, because he had the largest Laserdisc collection and it didn't go very well with Laserdisc. And he was like, I went on Laserdisc. And I was like, this isn't Laserdisc, man. These are, you know, this is DVD and they have all the features and it's so much more affordable. And the picture quality is so much better than VHS because, you know, I look back on, I know I'm not one of these people who has like a home theater and is like obsessed with getting the right blacks and the right sound system and, you know, or like always having to be projected on film when I go see a movie, because growing up, I experienced most of my movie watching VHS, which is a crap, you know, system where low resolution, the screen's cut off. And sound is shit. And like, that's how I fell in love with movies. So like, I don't really, you know, the compression rate of Netflix, you know, Netflix looks like shit in other reasons, but the compression rate doesn't really bother me.
Yeah, it's funny. I still remember the phrase, be kind, rewind, you know, and how they would ding you, you know, like if you didn't rewind it and they would sell the head cleaners. You know, I don't know why it's all popping back into my mind, but, you know, you had to clean the head.
I'm very nostalgic for video stores and VHS. And I was the guy who had to rewind the videos when you didn't rewind them. And we were an independent video store. And so independent video stores made money from renting porn. And we had porn tapes, and the funny thing about porn tapes is they were always you always had to rewind them. No one ever rewound a porn tape. And there's something, you know, 99% of the people renting were men. And it's like, they would watch it until they did what they needed to do to the video, and then they would stop and they would turn the video in. And I always would joke that, like, if you rewind 45 seconds, you could see the moment that, like, you know, they were excited to finish. And then, and then also when we would see it was a porn video being dropped in, we would like put a glove on and like clean it, because the odds of like them completing the task, going to wash their hands, then getting the video was probably
a very hotel remote control vibe going on there. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
The nostalgia of that. It's naturally my kids. My oldest is 23. My youngest is 20. And when we're watching Stranger Things, I think they did a pretty interesting job of kind of capturing the moment, or at least the mall vibe, you know. I've found myself in these little moments of nostalgia lately, you know, just kind of remembering. And maybe it's because the times we live in, or maybe an era back, you remember back when comedy was king, you know. I mean, you had comedy movies coming out regularly, and I've spoken to different folks and, you know, we talk about the economics of it and whatever, but I'm kind of curious, as a Gen X kid, what are your thoughts on comedy film, you know, like the ones, you know, just kind of the goofy comedies or just comedies in general, and just not having as many now as you did back in the day? And, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I think it's symptomatic of two things. The increasing importance of, and we're talking movies, the increasing importance of international box office. Comedy doesn't travel well. You know, comedy's pretty language specific. There are comedies that have done well, but usually they're like I think the best international comedy, if not the best, top five was the Ted, you know, the the bear, because you could dub anything into the bear's mouth, and you know,
that's true.
And it would curse in Spanish, it could curse in Romanian, whatever, you know. So animation, you know, comedy translates very well, obviously, because you can just report the language in, but sort of all the comedies that we loved in the 80s and 90s didn't necessarily translate in this layer, action comedies. And that's where all screen comedy has kind of gone, one of those reasons because of that. But I also think the second main reason is, you know, a splinting of the monoculture into, you know, a thousand different mini cultures. To laugh at something is a communal experience that has some relation to a shared understanding of the world. And I think we've lost that in a myriad of ways. And, you know, the feeling of going to a crowd and laughing with a crowd and feeling something in unison is not something that our culture really seems to be aspiring to at the moment. You know, I think it speaks to division, but I also just think it speaks to just the fragmentary nature of a, you know, 25, I guess now we're probably 35 years into like the internet becoming, you know, the main medium through which we seek entertainment. And it's just hard to compete with, you know, whatever micro interests you have. You can find 100 people that are into that you can talk to. So going to a theater and having that communal experience doesn't, you know, work as well. And comedy on TV has kind of gone away too. And, you know, but at the same time, comedy on front-facing comedy on Instagram, on TikTok is, you know, arguably the most popular format of social media. So it's not like people don't want to laugh anymore. It's just, I feel like they're doing it in ways that are more hyper-specific and hyper-targeted than sort of mass entertainment.
I know I've talked about on my show a few times, missing you know, the Judd Apatow comedies, you know, going back to like Anchorman, just something, you know, you're going to go in, you can disconnect from reality a little, you can laugh, you know. And I just kind of noticed that the stuff that comes out now, it's just, it's a different tone. I think being a Gen X kid, a little skewed, because we grew up in like tons of different kind of, I mean, God, we grew up with Sam Kinison and, you know, Eddie Murphy, you know, all that stuff that probably wouldn't really fly right now, to say the least. But what were you watching, you know, as far, if you want to say what was not influencing you, but what, you know, if you looked at kind of the Mount Rushmore things that you were watching that kind of informed you, not just with writing, but just in general, you know, what kind of turned you on back in the day?
I was pretty omnivorous, an omnivore. You know, I watched pretty much every sitcom that was on TV. The only ones I didn't watch were like the ones that were, you know, there was no time shifting, right? There was no on demand. So I would watch a comedy at 8:30. I'd watch a comedy at 9, you know, and if there was another comedy on at 8:30 that I didn't like as much, that would be the one I didn't watch. So I watched like 5 seasons of television shows I didn't particularly like. I just liked them more than the other shows that were on at that time slot. Like, I remember I watched every episode of Coach, and I was never more than moderately entertained. But there's something about sitcom rhythm and about comedy, even in middling forms, that I really liked from a young age. You know, I was seeing pretty much everything in the theater by the time I was, I remember when I was 10, I saw Unforgiven in the theater with my dad, which is a pretty adult movie for 10. Yeah. I have a 10-year-old. I don't think I would, was you it know, Gene its original Hackman, title yeah. was Am Gene I Hackman. Yeah, with Clint Eastwood. The original title of it, the script, was The Cut Whore Murders. So that should give you an example of what I was watching when I was 10 with my dad. He just wanted to take me to whatever. So whatever he wanted to see. So I would see everything, dramas, action movies, comedies. My dad didn't like horror, so we didn't go see horror in the movies. But then on TV, you know, I'd watch 1 hour. I really liked NYPD Blue. But I was definitely a comedy fan who preferred comedy and watched every, you know, comedy I could. I think the game changer for me was, I was probably in seventh grade. So I'm 12. So this is probably 1993. Kids in the Hall, Canadian sketch show, I think had been on for a few seasons, but finally started airing on Comedy Central. And so I hadn't seen that. And they were airing it every, they had enough episodes that hadn't aired on cable before that they were airing it, like, for me, after school every day for like an hour. You know, I think it's a fairly common experience of people my age, you know, that like Kids in the Hall sort of, for comedy nerds, sort of blew my mind. It was so much, I would say, more risk-taking. There were avant-garde, certainly, moments of it. It was queer. It was absurdist. Really well-written. Really well-shot. It was just unlike anything I had seen before. And it sort of, that opened my mind to all kinds of alternative comedy and also sort of, I think, set me on the path to what I do now in terms of, you know, what I find funny and what I think is, you know, best about comedy. I think all starts from there.
Yeah, do you remember, I don't know why it just popped in my mind, but not necessarily the news. Do you remember that show way back? I don't know if they put it on HBO or...
Yeah, I think that was on HBO. That was a little before my time. I liked the thing that was probably after, because I was big into sketch. So the thing after Kids in the Hall was a show called Mr. Show with Bob Odenkirk and David Cross. And that was happening as I was watching it. Like, Kids in the Hall was like, you know, it had been maybe shot like 3-4 years before I started watching it. That was the only like sort of thing that I was like very into as it was on. And both of them, I think, are pretty, you know, are considered like alternative comedy sketch classics. And yeah, I really gravitate to those two shows.
Yeah, so your dad was kind of like your Sherpa to the theatrical experience, you know, doing the double features and whatever. But I mean, what was his background? Did he have some kind of creative gig, or did he do something totally unrelated?
He was sort of semi-related. He ran the public access television station in Sacramento. So, you know, I think two things in my career came out of that. One, the belief that anyone should be able to make television. Anyone should be able to express themselves. You know, they used to have a slogan, free speech equals free media. Mm-hmm. I do think, you know, in the world we sort of live in now, you can see the first thing that the powerful do once they take over communications networks is try to limit your ability to communicate. Anyone, you know, on the new TikTok versus the old TikTok, you know, the American right wing owners took over and immediately limited what you could search for, what you could post, you know, change the algorithm to,
well, I mean, to, now,
you know, push things on you.
I remember being a kid, remembering the, now I don't mean to be political, but, you know, the Republicans were really, I remember Reagan broke up the phone system, you know, AT&T was, everything was a monopoly. And now they're, when it comes to media, just talking about linear media, like you have two big TV groups, you know, that are going to merge up here. It looks like.
I mean,
like
all of these, every time, you know, Fox selling to Disney, you know, every merger, you know, AT&T and then Discovery buying Warner Brothers, now Warner Brothers selling to Netflix or Paramount, you know, the options being like selling to Paramount and becoming a right-wing government mouthpiece, right? Or selling to Netflix and, you know, eliminating theatrical distribution. Like, you know, it's pretty dark the other way. Yeah, I mean, the other countries don't do this, you know, unlimited monopolies and fewer and fewer controls over the media. There are rules in place for reasons. And, you know, for my career, my industry, it's catastrophic. It's less jobs, it's less shows, it's less options of shows, it's more control from the people running them. And, you know, the thing that's sort of unique about where we are now is there was a entertainment used to mean one thing, and now it sort of means another, by which I mean, used to be have to be entertaining, right? You go back, if we go from the days of filmed media, right, the beginning, I was, as I said, a film studies major, so well aware of film history. So it starts with the Nickelodeons. You go to a hall, they have a little movie playing, you put a nickel in, you look at it, and then it plays like a 90-second, you know, two-minute clip of film. You know, it's a train going through the station. It's a picturesque view of Moscow. It's two people. The kiss was a famous one of, like, two people kissing, you know. So that starts of, like, you know, then they start projecting on a screen. Then they start doing crowds to make more money. And it was entertaining. And you went to be entertained. Now, entertainment isn't about whether you liked it, whether you entertained, but about whether you engaged with it, right? It's about attention. It's gone from interest to attention, because you can give something attention that you have no interest in or not really
particularly.
And so then when you're saying that, like, you know, algorithms now are, you know, from the major streaming companies are dictating, you know, certain story moves, certain sort of repeat of information, because they're recognizing, well, our viewers aren't that interested in what's going on the screen at any given time. It's a second screen experience. They have their laptop open. They're checking TikTok while they're watching the streaming movie. And so it's not about whether it's entertaining, because it can't, or we don't even care if it's trying to pull them back from the phone. We'll live with the phone. We just want it on to be background wallpaper that they enjoy having on. And that is a unique thing. That's the thing. I don't know if I can ever really embrace being the second screen. You know, if you're in reality TV, you're in a Hallmark movie kind of thing. That's a second screen experience. You know it. And they're, you know, I had a buddy who used to cut reality TV, and there are things they do to pull you back to the television because it's an important point. They do like dings and like music stings. Raise the volume of dialogue so that you look up from your phone. Oh, this is important. You know, that kind of thing, it's tough for me to engage in, because that's not certainly what I, you know, this is commercial art. It's art in a commercial setting that has to have, you know, commercial compromises that I'm completely comfortable with.
Do you think this is a pendulum, though? Do you think it's something that will swing back? It's generational, like maybe the Gen Z kids are finally going to go, you know, I kind of want something a little, you know, they're the tastemakers now, you know, they're the ones that kind of like in our era, back when like, it's amazing when I still think that MTV is no more, because I remember years ago when I worked on the radio, they said you had to watch MTV to know the pulse of what's happening culturally in the country, you know, for a certain generation. Do you think that like the younger generation is going to go, oh, kind of rediscover sitting down and engaging with 30 minutes or an hour of content, of programming, put it like that?
Well, I mean, for a lot of the kids growing up, there is no difference between, you know, 2 hours of scrolling on TikTok and watching a two-hour movie. The two-hour movies, you know, it's the same amount of time to them, and the movie's boring because it's only one thing and they can watch God knows how many TikToks, right? So I don't know if it'll swing back to ever being, you know, the same sort of cultural center point, but you know, I'm on Letterboxd, which is a sort of, you know, social media just for like movies. And there's a lot of like younger generation, you know, people in their late 20s, early 30s. I'm 45. So, you know, a couple generations below me that are on Letterboxd and sort of falling in love with movies for the first time. The difference to me is it's kind of niche. Now, it's niche of like a certain, you know, high percentage, you know, like it's definitely like millions of people in America are of a younger generation and are getting into movies and revival screenings and logging the movies and talking about them, which I think wasn't the case maybe 10 years ago. But it doesn't seem to be a mass movement. So it's tough for me to, you know, like with each AI iteration that can, you know, deep fake more and more slop, you know, I would hope that future generations will continue to try to engage with visual art and choose it over slop. Thing about slop, though, it comes out thick and heavy, and it's unending. It's a tube that will never stop. You cannot shut it off, and so it's tough to. I think that's, you know, not my pessimism, but my sort of cynicism, maybe.
I was listening to Matt Damon say something in an interview the other day saying what you said with Netflix, like the way things are written now, you have to reintroduce people to the plot intermittently, you know, because you don't know where they're joining, the ADHD, whatever it happens to be. But as a creative, do you have this little battle between doing it the way you want and the way it's going to work on the screen? Is it a little bit of a challenge for you? Or are you kind of obstinate going, I'm going to do it my way?
You know, I'm in a unique position because I have a show on the air right now called Going Dutch. It airs on Fox Broadcast. So in some way, I'm doing a workplace sort of light sitcom that takes, you know, that airs on a broadcast network. So I'm like the most antiquated form of broadcast and television. You know, it's like this is not cutting edge. So I haven't really been given any sort of algorithmic notes on this project. And of the other ones I've done, I haven't either. So I don't have any firsthand experience. I know that they do exist, and specifically with movies, they have certain kind of rules. But the thing that, you know, the algorithm, it sort of anesthetizes you to art, right? It, you know, the central reason they're like, oh, well, our research says or our numbers say means that we get the most engagement, meaning the least people turn it off if these things happen in this order in a general sense, which might be true, but it's sort of like one of those things of like, if you have 100% Rotten Tomato movie, you know, that doesn't mean it's the best movie of all time. That just means like 100% of the critics generally were like, yeah, it's good, you know? Whereas like the best movies probably have like a 92% on Rotten Tomatoes because they engendered enough, you know, dialogue that some people didn't like it, even though a lot of people really liked it, right? And so I think like an algorithm-driven platform that is, you know, is feeding you things to consume, it's trying to make it go down as easy as it can. And I'm, you know, I'm not, I've watched plenty of challenging art. You know, I went to film school. I've watched non-narrative art. I like sort of, you know, growing up in America the way I do, I like a classical Hollywood storytelling, but I also like storytelling that challenges me and that is trying to tell me a story that in a way I haven't seen before. And that's, you know, ultimately I still think what I try to do. And, you know, on this particular show, a lot of times the powers that be push back, but I'm always trying to tell you a familiar story in an unfamiliar way. And I still think there's value in that. And so, you know, if they pay me enough and, you know, I'm employed in this bleak entertainment market, I'll listen to what the algorithm says too. But I still think my storytelling instincts, are a little more challenging than what the algorithm, I think, dictates.
Right now, what is it that you know, that you're like, okay, they're doing it right. I really enjoy this. What's out there right now that's that's kind of on your, I don't want to say your DVR, because I don't know if anybody really, DVRs are a thing, you know, but.
Yeah, everything's on demand. What am I into now? A friend of mine created the show Wonder Man that's on Disney Plus. It's like a Marvel show. That's like a very unique Marvel show because it's mostly about two sad middle-aged actors, one of them who accidentally has superpowers. I'm enjoying that. I think that's very fun. I went back and I watched, you know, some of the movies that got nominated this year, and I really like Blue Moon, the Richard Linklater movie.
Yeah, anything I love. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, he's pretty prolific, and so like he's made a lot of movies. I've seen pretty much all of them. I'd say this. I think this is a top five. I would put it after the Before movies and Dazed and Confused, but I would probably put it. I can think that makes it fifth. I really think it's exceptional. I think the script is really good. The performance is good. It's also about, I've written in a lot of creative partnerships. It's sort of what that movie's about. And it does get to it, you know, a truth about that experience of the ways your lives can become enmeshed. And it starts to become difficult whose idea was it originally and what different working styles are. And, you know, I thought that was exceptional. I really liked The Bone Temple 28 years later. That, I thought that was incredible. I saw that in the theater. Just liked Send Help a lot, the new Sam Raimi movie. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, there's still good stuff being made, and I try to support it, you know, as whenever something is good, I try to sort of, you know, with my eyeballs or my wallet, make my presence known to support it. And so those, all of those things I think are, and all of them are the kind of thing that I'm talking about, which is that, you know, they're unexpected and they're surprising. And I think the more, and I still think it's true, like the more, you know, you become inundated with certain types of storytelling, and when things become rote and predictable, you can kind of tune out. And yeah. So I'm just a big fan of, you know, I just took my youngest, you know, I live near a place called Vidiot's, which they do, like, it's a repertory house, so they'll play, like, you know, older movies. And as I said, you know, growing up, a lot of my first time experiences watching things were VHS DVDs I rented from them, you know. So I, things like, I had never seen Alien on the big screen or Thief on the big screen, you know.
Oh, that's what this is. They kind of bring back older movies and get them up on the big screen. Now, that's cool.
Yes,
that's,
and they do like cool programming, and they do themes, and they'll do, you know, Rob Reiner past. They've been doing Rob Reiner movies, and so they did a screening at 4 o'clock, like right after school, for Princess Bride, and I took my youngest daughter, and took her a little while, but she locked in on it and was really having fun by the end. And she, one thing she screamed out was, like, with about 10 minutes to go, she was like, "Nothing is happening in this movie the way I thought it was going to happen." And I was like, yeah, that is kind of the strength. It's William Goldman, right? One of the great screenwriters, wrote the book originally and then adapted his own book. And that is kind of the key to it, is it's a fairy tale that ends with the good guys win, you know, they go off and get married, love triumphs, but every single step on the way to get there doesn't happen in the order that it would in a normal fairy tale. He dies halfway through, you know, like, you know, he disappears from the story immediately, you know, because he like dies off in the thing, then comes back. Like, it just is unpredictable. While, you know, and I do think that's what everyone is, if you're trying to go for a story for entertainment, which most people are, then I think that's what you want, which is you want, you know, an unpredictable journey to a safe, warm place, you know, at the end that you hoped it went to.
Well, how old are your kids?
They are 10, and one's 6, about to be 7. And
okay,
she'll
okay
count down the days.
So you still have Disney Channel show theme music in your mind all day long. I don't know if you're, because my kids were like, sure. I could. It's so strange to be at that age now where some of the Disney Channel kids they grew up with are now very much adult actors, you know. And I'm like,
yes. My youngest, she's gotten into like old 2000s, like kid sitcoms. And then she'll be like, what's this person look like now? And I'll be like, well, they're 35. Here's what they look like, you know? Yeah, but they love the thing, you know, my victory as a parent is they both like going to the movies. They both like watching TV, which, you know, back in my day, it was like, oh, TV's going to rot your brain. Well, now we know what true brain rot is, and it's the YouTube algorithm, and it's social media. Nonstop streaming. Actual television with storytelling is much better, you know? So there was a while where they would, you know, I have screen time on all their devices, and they'd be like, I don't watch YouTube. And I'm like, no more YouTube. And I was like, you can watch wherever you want as long as it has a story.
It's funny you mentioned YouTube, because I think they're doing it for adults too. I think it's not just the kids can kind of get wrapped up in the algorithm, because I'm a big fan of independent media. I mean, what we were just talking about before with the corporations and all that. I mean, I'm trying to support that. I've even noticed, you know, the big thing now is the thumbnails. They try to, like, you know, I want to go get little bits and pieces of, like, news commentary, you know, something that's somewhat unbiased, but, you know, I want to feel like I'm a little educated on the moment. But you look at the way they try to pull you in, and it's almost like not a dopamine hit. They want to kick that fight or flight button that, you know, when it comes to news. You know, I used to kind of goof on, like, the BBC way of doing news, where they sit there just reading a teleprompter in a very boring way. I kind of miss that, you know?
Yeah, I think that, to me, it goes back to the point I was making earlier about, like, the difference between entertainment and, like, attention and engagement, right? They don't really want to entertain you. They want to engage you. And the quickest way to engage you is with a soldier returns from war and the dog recognizes them, you know, like, which honestly, all that shit's now AI. Like, the easiest thing AI can do is do, and you can always tell, because, like, the fucking animal will, like, do something and cheat the camera, like Jim from The Office. All AI animal videos do that now. And it's such a ridiculous sort of, like, you know, but people love it. Oh, look at the dog. It looked at the camera, right? And they can't tell it's fake and they love it, right? So something gives you the warm awes, that'll get shared, that'll get engagement, right? Or something that, you know, wherever you are on the political spectrum, right? If you're right wing, being like, you know, they're force feeding hormones into your children's food at school, whatever lie, bullshit thing gets you to click on the article. And now you're watching a video, and then you watch one video, and then that sells you another video. If you're on the left, you know, it'll be, you know, I mean, how many things do I have that, like, look what Trump's up to now, you know, and then whatever. And then we're engaged in that sort of,
And then you have that moment where you go, tirade. How long have I been watching this? Like, why am I still watching this? You ever have that moment and go, like, well, I've just been sitting here watching, and it's a daisy chain effect.
Yeah.
Like,
well, that's what they call doom scrolling. I do think there's a, you know, there will be a movement away from, I mean, I've told my oldest that, like, you're not going to be on social media till, you know, late high school. Yeah. Like, I think we'll look back on, like, giving children social media in 20 years and be like, you know, giving a 10-year-old a cigarette, you know? Like, my generation, unfiltered access to Coca-Cola products, you know? Like, when my kids go now, like, so you guys just drink caffeine soda? I was like, all day long. It's all we do. Sugar and caffeine.
Yeah.
I think that'll be what social media is in the future, because it just is, like, it's just not good for kids to have. And the doom scrolling, and I think even my kids, like, they get annoyed by the screen time. But my oldest sees the point of it, you know, that, like, and it helps that, like, I put an app blocker on my phone. I give myself screen time, you know, because that sort of 2-hour, 3-hour time suck where it's 8 o'clock and you start checking reels on your phone and all of a sudden you're getting tired and you're ready to go to bed. And where did the night go? You know, I think that's a dangerous 3 hours, because you're not thinking, you're not really engaging with anything. You're not even engaging with a story. You're not learning anything. It's just the lizard part of your brain is just getting tickled, you know? And you have the illusion of choice with the ability to scroll. So, like, you know, I think ultimately that's bad. I think it's bad for the human mind. And, you know, I think, the comparison I would make is to analytics in sports, right? Where it's like the more math sort of got into baseball, got into basketball, they changed the game in certain ways. That, you know, basketball, pointing out that the three-pointer was underutilized and, you know, it's worth so many more points, so you should jack up as many threes as possible. Baseball, strikeouts, walks, those are the most important thing. Like, keep putting the ball in play, contact speed don't really matter that much, right? So the analytics pushed the game in a certain direction that became actually, you know, I think both games are more aesthetically displeasing than 20 years ago, the versions of it, right?
That's and really interesting, like, to say. There's less passion. I don't find that people get passionate at the same in the same way about it for the same reasons, you know. Even now, it's like this. I was watching something the other day about, you know, talk about having a phone in your hand, the gambling aspect of it. So they're tapping different parts of people's brain. And I don't know how much, like, when we were watching stuff, there was joy. There was, I won't say joy, but there was more of an emotional kind of connection as opposed to a reactionary connection to something. I don't know if that makes any sense or not.
Just finishing off the point of, like, and to referencing what you're talking about, like, I think that sort of data analysis for an algorithm for social media is also pushing us to things that, like, are not only not good for us, but, like, if you actually looked back and you thought about it, is, like, not that entertaining. It's just addictive, and there's just so much of it, you know? And so I think that, like, yeah, the danger is we're pushing entertainment to a place of it's Cool Whip, you know? It's like, it's all empty calories that have no actual value at all, but it tastes good. And, you know, you can have as much of it as you want, right? And I don't, you know, it might be the sort of internet streaming companies, you know, that's their prerogative. I do think, like, I don't know if it'll be, we were talking about if it'll switch back, but I do think there will be in the future a large percentage of people that will reject this. And there's a thing called the dead internet theory, which seems to be coming true, which is essentially, like, the internet is becoming more and more broken and more false, you know, with all these fake videos.
Yeah.
And so at a certain point, if you cannot believe anything you see on your phone, why would you engage with it to the same degree? You know,
absolutely.
If influencers, if sports, if, I don't know if this clip is real or if it's not, like, why are we, you know, why do we want to live in a world of pretend online? It was one thing when these devices were windows onto another world that maybe was happening outside of where we were that could be more exciting. But if it's an invented world that we don't engage with or don't appreciate, you know, I think at a certain point people will lose interest in it because it'll just have no actual meaning.
I think that's instinctive because I remember back, let's see, I got into doing, you know, I was in radio for a while, you know, in voiceover, and there was a phrase like real person, conversational, authentic. It was started in the 90s, or that's when I first heard, when I first got involved, started performing. And that kept snowballing more and more and more. You know, you want authenticity. And I think that's our default position as humans. And if we're not consuming something which is authentic, after a while, it's like you said, a bunch of empty calories. We want nutrition. And that's going to be the thing that kind of, you know, turns us on, something a little bit different. Like you mentioned sports. And I look at, like, you know, Brock Meyer as being just kind of a story within sports, which is, you know, cool. But the genesis of that wasn't it a Funny or Die thing? Or maybe, am I imagining that?
No, it started off as the Funny or Die video. It really started off as a character that Hank Azaria had been, a voice and a character he had sort of been doing. And then he brought that character to Funny or Die, and then they did the Funny or Die video. I was at Funny or Die, but I didn't work on that video. But I liked it and thought it was funny. And then at the time I worked there, which was like maybe 2010, 2011, I was kind of their sports guy because the Venn diagram of comedy nerd, sports nerd, you know, it's a thin slice in the middle. Yeah. So there wasn't a lot of guys that, you know, love sketch and comedy like I did that also could write for any of the major sports. And so I started doing all of their, I did stuff for the NFL Network. I did stuff for TBS Playoff Baseball. I, you know, whenever they would come to Funny or Die for sports, I started, you know, working with professional athletes, which was cool. And one of the things that we worked on was a series of appearances with Hank Azaria as Brockmire. And I sort of instantly felt at home in the character because I had grown up listening to baseball on the radio and knew these guys, knew the Bob Uecker, knew, you know, Marty Brenneman in Cincinnati, you know, knew, you know, Keith Hernandez in New York, like these sort of like larger than life baseball broadcasters who were kings of their local market. And, you know, there, I thought there was a lot of comedy in, you know, the way they would do these digressions, you know, because as sort of people who know baseball, you know, they know that in any 3-hour game, I think there's 17 minutes of actual gameplay, maybe less. Yeah, so it's a lot of, it's a lot of time to fill. Right. And so you get these verbose, always men with deep voices and, real characters. And so I got the voice and wrote for him and was able to do appearances in that voice and really, you know, had a lot of fun with it. They asked me to write a movie. I wrote a movie that we almost got made with Hank and Marissa Tomei playing the female lead. And then the money fell out, independent production, as sometimes happens, usually, you know, happens a lot in independent film. And then it was kind of dead. And then I started working in TV, comedy writing, sitcoms. And they came back to me and they're like, hey, do you want to pitch this as a show? I said, yeah, in some ways it makes more sense as a show. And I, my experience at that point is much more in television. And so, and it was really at a unique time. It was like 2015. So it was sort of, I would think now that's considered sort of the golden age of sort of, you know, television media. Cable still existed. You know, it was right after The Sopranos and Breaking Bad and The Wire and Girls, you know. So it was like, what is a half-hour comedy? What is a drama? What can you do? How far can you push it? Was all sort of up in the air. And I really sort of, I wanted it to be in the world of sports, but really be about America. And I, you know, because I'm a cynical person, but I also, you know, wanted to have a sort of theme running through it. And so right away from the first season, I was like, oh, the show is a man gets better as a country gets worse. That's the show. And so I took this sort of degenerate and I sort of, you know, had him be profligate in his degeneracy. Then I had him get sober. Then I had him sort of work through what being a good person feels like, then what being a good father feels like. All the while, the background is the sort of countries falling apart around him. Now, I didn't know in 2015 how accurate, you know, my cynicism about America was going to be. I think it's one of the reasons that the show really holds up. It's just on Netflix now. And I'm getting a lot of people responding to it again because it was sort of not available to stream for a couple years. And, you know, the final season of the show takes place in an apocalyptic 2030s where there's a AI company that has completely taken over the entire economy and a sort of right-wing fascist government. You know, I wrote that in 2019, you know, and so then it came out in the pandemic of 2020 and it was not the kind of vibe people were looking for. But I do think if you watch it now, there's a lot of jokes that I think will play as commentary on our current moment that I wrote.
I didn't catch that season. I need to go back in and watch that. A little funny side note. My kids love going to baseball games and I was in New Orleans at the time. And I was like, you know what? I've done everything on a microphone I think you could do, but I've never done PA announcing for, you know, professional sports. I was like, maybe I could do that. There is a AAA team for the Miami Marlins in New Orleans. And I was like, shit, I'll go do that. Why not? So I decided for a couple seasons to do that. And it's kind of exhausting because you're dealing with at least 70 games per, you know, season. I'm like, had other things going on. I didn't realize what kind of a time suck it would be. But it was cool. My kids can come and stadium was near the house. And they did a Brockmire night. And they had these Crawdaddy's jerseys that they'd give out. So yeah. I didn't know if you knew that.
Because that year we did I have the patch here somewhere for the Crawdaddies. I was really proud of coming up with the name New Orleans Crawdaddies. And then I gave a lot of input on the logo and the mascot. If there's anything one of my true joys in working in this business was getting a chance to design of fake minor league teams, logos and colors. I even love this. The first team was the Morristown Frackers, and I based their color on the 70s Padres, like mustard, yellow dark brown, you know? So I really do have an affinity and a love for baseball in all its forms. And going back to what you're saying, what I tried to sort of invest in the show is, I think baseball, because it's 162 games, right? No, and it's a very, what I always say about baseball is, because it's America's first sport and really one of the first, you know, I guess you could say soccer, tennis, you know, predated golf, but it's one of the first spectator sports that really like took off. And so it's almost like, it's like when you see like a nautilus or something in the ocean that's like 60 million years old, and you're like, why does it move like that? And you're like, well, it took a while for evolution to sort of, like, there's these archaic things about baseball that like would never fly anymore. You know, if you were to design a game now, knowing what we know about sports, one of them is it's 162 games. So there's something about like every day you're playing a game. Every day you're playing a 3-hour game. So there's something very existential about baseball because it's day to day. You're not even really building. There are big games, but there's a big game and there's a game the next day. You struck out, you know, five times. Okay, there's a game tomorrow. And there's something about that, like, life, that every day, the drudgery, you keep going, that, like, that's a part of the game that I think is a beautiful part of the game. But I thought it related well to a kind of existentialist comedy, you know, and so we sort of leaned into those themes, I think.
Yeah, I think that baseball gives you a chance. It's a lot of time for introspection, you know. You know, a lot of time, like you said, there's only 17 minutes of play or whatever that is, you know, whatever you got. So there's always some kind of promotion or something that, you know, the owners want to make money. And minor league ball is its own world, which is, you know, because you've got these guys that are working their way up. At the same time, you got guys that are multimillionaires coming down because they're, they were injured or something. It's just, I'm just like an infinite observer. I just like watching, you know, just the personalities and stuff like that. So it's a wonderful canvas to paint on. But I was going to ask you, for the future, man, you did work with Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. How did that partnership come along? Were they involved in Funny or Die, or how did that come together?
No, it wasn't through Funny or Die. It was after Brockmeyer. I came in and interviewed on the show, and the first season, and I think didn't get it, but came very close. And then for the second season, I think they had regretted maybe not hiring me, and so they reached out again. And you know, I was showrunning my own show, but it was, you know, the current way that television works is it was 8 episodes. It was on cable. So like even showrunning your own show, I had to work on other shows during the off season. So I would work on Future Man in between seasons of Brockmeyer. And I love sci-fi, and I love all the movies that they're referencing and sort of pulling from and sort of iterating off of. And, you know, and I liked that it was a sci-fi comedy where we were like trying to, you know, keep the rules consistent and really create a sci-fi universe that sort of made sense. And it was great. Point Grey, which is the company that Seth and mm-hmm. Evan run, really artist first, you know, great people, no assholes. All the people they hire, the directors, are all people they've worked with before. Ben Carlin.
Yeah, that kind of even goes back to that Judd Apatow, what was that show? The show happened, all these guys worked together on in high school.
Freaks and Geeks.
Freaks and Geeks. Yeah. Which is funny how that show didn't run longer than it did. But it seems like that whole ecosystem of guys and gals, they just kind of all sort of still kind of interact in one way or another. And they're all doing good stuff.
I think definitely the company Seth is running is different than Judd Apatow's in different ways. But I do think he's pulling things, obviously, because, you know, Judd Apatow found him when he was like a 16-year-old kid. So, like, he's definitely like, it's a version of, you know, that sort of world. And so that was a great show to work on. Really loved it. One of the, you know, it was expensive and it got pulled off, I think, as a write down. And so I don't even know if it's streaming anywhere now, because it got sort of, when Zaslav started Zaslaving, other people started like, I can Zaslav. So it got Zaslaved off of Hulu. But there was a really good idea that I didn't write, but I pitched a lot on that I thought was so interesting, which was we told an episode that took place in the last season in a time pocket. So it was like a pocket of time where time didn't exist, and trying to tell a story in a place where time doesn't exist, I thought was very fun and challenging. And I thought we did a really funny job with it. It's a bummer that, like, you know, it's difficult to see, because I do think the whole show was really funny and smart and expensive. It looked great, you know, which I think are all things that are rare these days. Like, everything kind of looks like shit. There's been many dark, challenging times in the industry in the last, I would say, 5-6 years. And the idea that work, you know, the old industry that, you know, I grew up with, like, you know, if it was television, it aired once, maybe there'd be repeats. It kind of went off into the ether and to never be seen from again. And so there was a certain zen, you know, writing in the sand on the beach, the waves are going to wash away quality to it. But at least people saw it. The idea that you made something, you craftspeople made it, people acted into it, $80-100 million was spent on a TV show, on a movie, and that all that exists now is as a tax write-off, and as a tax write-off, it can never be seen. That, you know, and I had experienced that a little bit too, because I worked on the second season of Minx, which was an HBO Max show. Zaslav was Zaslaving, and he was killing things left and right. And I was like, oh, he's going to kill this show. It's expensive. It doesn't fit in with what he wants HBO Max to me. They don't own it. So there's all these reasons it doesn't make sense if he's going to fuck with things. But we were in the writer's room. So I'm like, we had guaranteed contracts. So I'm like, they're probably going to just pay us out and just cancel it and we'll never go into production. Well, we went into production. I was like, great. Wrote a season that I was really proud of, you know, looked great, very fun, very good show. And then production was wrapping like first week in January, last week in December, they canceled it and they let the show go on, not because they wanted to see it, but because they wanted a bigger tax write-off. So they didn't cancel it in the beginning because they wanted to let it go and, you know, so they could take a bigger write-down on it. We eventually like sold it to, you know, the season was complete. Lionsgate owned it. They put it on Stars. No one saw it. Now it's on Netflix. People are finally watching it. But that was a new experience for me to be like,
that's going to be soul crushing. It's like being a chef and cooking, knowing there's going to throw your food in the trash. You know?
Yeah, it was very strange. And, you know, I will say that, like, I don't think it was successful. it was successful in terms of that David Zaslav is a lot richer than he was before. But in terms of like the company's health, you know, they never could get out from under the debt. It's not good to be known as a company who doesn't produce things. And then I would say they had a really good run of movies and they hired really good people like Mike DeLuca, good people meaning smart and good taste. And he did a string of hits this year and then they sold it, you know, or, you know, it sort of was treating this company as, you know, like a pump and dump and, you know, and it was stupid. And yet, you know, Zaslav's having the last laugh from his yacht, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one question to kind of go back to going Dutch, how did you come up with the idea of it taking the show taking place in the Netherlands? I don't know if any show I can think of has ever taken place in the Netherlands, like in other or set in the Netherlands rather. How did that idea come to you?
Dennis Leary was a fan of Brockmire, and we had a couple really good meetings where we really vibed, and he came to me about developing a show for him, a sitcom. And I, you know, was in a headspace of Dennis Leary is one of our great comedic yellers. He's a blue collar guy, even after being famous for 30 years. So he's fireman. He's played a lot of cops. And I was like, oh, he hasn't played a lot of soldiers. And so I was like, well, he's so good at yelling and we could make him like a high up guy. He's like angry, like a real American tough man. And then I was like, okay, well, if that's the character, what's the funniest place to put him? So I Googled least important U.S. Army base in world. And this base called Skinnin came up that has closed, but closed in like maybe like 2012. And it closed for all of the reasons we make fun of this base for. Like, it didn't really have to exist for any reason. They were constantly giving it jobs for other bases that the other bases could have done. And it had the true thing about it was what it was known for was having the best bowling alley in Northern Europe. So they would have army wide German, like they would have like bowling tournaments there from the German bases, because this, you know, bowling alley was better. And there was the other thing we stole from the pilot was they had a teen center, but there were no children on base. So I thought, you know, this is funny. Like the idea of sticking this guy in this kind of purgatory where, you know, he wants to be, you know, MacArthur, he wants to be Patton, he wants to be on the pointed edge of the American sword being thrust into some international conflict, and instead he's stuck in the one place nothing ever happens. I thought that was funny, and then we came up with the daughter part of it to give it a little that the reason he is sent there is as punishment because, you know, he is estranged from his daughter, and his daughter, you know, is assigned there. And so the idea that it's a workplace comedy, smuggling in a family comedy, you know, we sort of liked. And, you know, that's the way we came up with it. And then Fox was looking for a show for him and wanted something that was to air after Animal Control, which is another sort of wacky workplace comedy. Mm-hmm. So we had an idea that it would fit in with what they were looking for. And we were right. And, you know, like, it's a very fun show to make. We shoot in Ireland, which was unique and interesting. And another statement of where we currently are in the entertainment industry. I'm shooting an American sitcom in Ireland. But the show, as you said, is based in the Netherlands. So having a European setting does help. You know, we can go outside and shoot in Ireland, and it's going to double for the Netherlands a lot easier.
But yeah, my best friend's from Holland, and I do appreciate the very first episode. You know, you didn't bring up stroopwafel, which is, you know, it's, they have the best snacks in the world in Holland, you know, and
they do, and they love I forget the name of it, but it's like they like love a happy hour, the bitterballen. They love a happy hour snack that is like sort of a cultural thing of like you going with your friends to the bar cafe and eating fried things and drinking, you know, beer or wine from the hours of 4 to 7 is a, you know, cultural wide thing. You know, we do a little bit of Netherlands stuff. It's a lot about Americans living abroad and sort of the culture clash between an American military base and, you know, a Dutch society that is, you know, sort of, what I say is like Americans always talk about freedom, but they just, you know, the Americans who talk about freedom the most mean the freedoms to say, you know, racial slurs and shoot any whoever they want. So, you know, actual freedom is like you can find in the Netherlands of like, I'm married to 9 people. I believe I'm a vampire. I only wear loincloths, you know, like actual freedom is like doing whatever the fuck you want as long as it doesn't hurt somebody. And that's, you can see that in Amsterdam, you know, not necessarily, you know, where this base is located, where we base it on this base Skinnin, and it's in the sort of like southernmost tip that's surrounded by Germany and Belgium. So it's actually kind of, that area would be, even people in the Netherlands consider it like not really the Netherlands, because it's sort of its own little orphan area that is a little German, it's a little Belgian. But, so we sort of have a little fun of the sort of Dutch, you know, open society that maybe doesn't quite exist there, but, you know, it's still more fun to sort of contrast that with American military culture.
Before we get going, I got what I call my 7 questions. I kind of like throw that on the back end here, a little extra fun, just randomness. And I always talk food. And we've done that, talked about bierballen and was it frikandel? That's another good one in Holland. First question I ask is, what's your favorite comfort food? That thing, good day, bad day, doesn't make a difference. It just makes you feel good. You know, it's kind of home for you.
I would say I would say the comfort food, I'm gonna bifurcate this into two different comforts. Comfort food, if I want something that's sort of going to make me feel good, and maybe if I feel a little sick, a little down, I'll order pho, Vietnamese chicken soup that I really like, the broth, the noodles. You know, it's a very sort of, you know, it's the same reason I think people like matzo ball soup of this sort of warm broth, and, you know, the chicken is great. Love that. And then I would say I also, but in terms of environment, I find diners very relaxing. As a kid, family went to a lot of diners, and that was sort of mainly where we went out. So there's something about it still feels a little fun, but I also like that it's a place where, you know, you go to a nice restaurant, you know, there's a certain kind of clientele, there's a certain level of class, you know, that's going to pay $150 for a meal, right? A diner's for everybody. You know, when I was shooting Brockmire in Atlanta, I used to go to the Waffle House a lot. And I really liked that the Waffle House was, one, I thought the Waffle House food was quite good. And then the other thing was, I was like, everybody goes to the Waffle House. Like rich people, poor people. You go after church, there's whole families. You go late at night, everyone's coming from the club and going to the Waffle House. Like,
yeah, it has way more character than Denny's does. You know, it's got its own ecosystem.
Listen, bar none, favorite part of the South, Waffle House. It's I would say that's the pinnacle of Southern culture that I experienced. Those are my answer to that one.
Very good, very good. Now, the next question I got is, if you're going to be sitting down, you and three people, living or not, going to be having, just talking story, having coffee for an afternoon or evening, who would those three people be that you would like to sit down with?
I love Buster Keaton. Loved him, fell in love with him in college. My youngest daughter's name is Keaton, after Buster Keaton. So I would love to talk comedy with him, specifically visual comedy. I think the reason in my mind his stuff holds up better than Chaplin's is he was so much more of a dynamic, visual filmmaker, and was playing with, almost had an engineer's mind of how to construct visual comedy on screen. So I'd love to pick his brain. Also, he has a million stories and has like was a child vaudeville star and like, you know, and could knock it back, but then he got sober. So I would try to meet him some point in the middle where he could drink, but not get too drunk, and have him there at the dinner. Then I would say, I'm a big fan of James L. Brooks, and sort of mystified by what's happened to him with the last few movies. But, you know, if you go back and you say who had a more totemic career in my lifetime, from, you know, early TV writing to Mary Tyler Moore Show, to Taxi, to The Simpsons, to Terms of Endearment, to Broadcast News, basically there's a 30-year period where if it was good in comedy, James L. Brooks, you know, had his hand in it. Also produced, you know, Wes Anderson's first movie, produced Cameron Crowe's first movie. So the ways in which his sort of comedic tentacles reached out to everything I cared about, probably not current day, maybe like 80s, 90s, if I can choose James L. Brooks, and maybe get his finger a little more on the pulse. And then, probably someone from the world of sports. I guess maybe Joe Montana. I'm a Niners fan from way back. He's an interesting guy. He has stories. He talks shit. You know, he's the original sort of, quarterback hero that I always had. And I think all the other, you know, Tom Brady grew up idolizing Joe Montana. So it's like, all of the greats thought he was the best. So I think, you know, luckily in my career, because I've done so much sports comedy, I've had the opportunity to hang out with athletes and to hear them tell some stories and to ask them questions and, you know, pick their brain. And I'm always endlessly fascinated, you know, because you grow up as a sports fan, it's a very one-way experience. You know, you're just appreciating things that are happening on a screen and you think it gives you some expertise, but you can never really understand like what it's like to be in that moment, even if playing your sports yourself, because the difference between high school sports and professional sports is a yawning gap. and to hear like what was going on the field in those moments, you know, how their minds work, what it takes to that professional level. It's something that I'm continually fascinated by.
Yeah, I still would love to have, and I'm still, you know, one of these days, I still love to get Nolan Ryan on and talk with him, because I was a big baseball guy. I grew up in the Dallas area, you know, he just, you know, in fact, I don't know if you remember way back, I saw their little promotional item. Baseball promotional items are hilarious sometimes. If you remember when he got into that fight, Robin Ventura charged the mound and they got in the, they have a bloodstained jersey giveaway as one of their first promotional items for this season, you know, because Nolan Ryan kept playing, but his jersey had blood on him. Like, I'll do anything to get one of those, you know, I'm a fan of the random baseball promotional stuff, you know.
I got bobbleheads here. My daughter plays with them.
Well, next question, God, is back when you were a kid, who was your very first celebrity crush?
First celebrity crush. It's weird because it was in Brockmire a lot, but I think because I was a fan of old movies, I really liked Anne Margaret a lot, and I made it sort of a joke in Brockmire that he was obsessed with Anne Margaret because it was more appropriate for Brockmire than it was for me. But like, I think peak Anne Margaret, you know, sort of like mid late 60s is like the most attractive human being that's ever lived. And there's a video of her dancing. It goes viral like every 18 months because it's the most like electrifying 90 seconds of video. It's her, I think it's a movie called like Shag or something, you know, or like The Happening. It's like some kind of like 60s young person comedy. And she's having a party at her house and she just dances across the room and like smokes a cigarette and like dances over to like different people at a cocktail party. And it's like the coolest, you know, sexiest, you know, most stylish, you know, 90 seconds of, and it's like,
some of those movies can be such a cool time machine to just like, oh, this is what people were into back then. And you get to kind of like get into a generation's head, you know, kind of in a way.
Yeah, and I don't know if we watched the whole movie, if we would define entertainment, but certainly that 90 seconds, there's a reason it keeps going around and people keep sending it to me. Like intellectual crush. The first thing I was probably, I really liked Roseanne. The show. And so I guess like, I'm not crushing on Roseanne, right? I was crushing on like, I loved my, you know, family was lower middle class. Like, you know, we weren't ever in danger of, you know, homelessness or not having food, but basically every expense beyond our basic needs had to be negotiated, right? It was, and the only lower middle class family I ever saw on television was the Connors, and how shitty their couch was with like a shitty, you know, blanket. Like I had a shitty couch and I had a shitty throw blanket. And the fact that it was like my, you know, their family was fucked up, my family was fucked up. But at the same time, the stories were interesting. It was always really funny. You didn't really know what was going to be one episode from the other. I was just obsessed with that show. And I think that, you know, we just don't do it anymore. We don't really engage with class, you know, certainly in sitcoms and comedy. And anytime I've tried to, I've gotten a lot of pushback. I don't know if there's some research that says people don't want to engage with it. I feel like people are struggling and they want to see that reality on screen.
Absolutely.
To a certain point.
Because people, you know, I'm sure you've seen the memes before when people think, what do the 80s look like? And then, you know, the house, you know, the bedrooms have all neon. It's all cliche 80s stuff. But no, the 80s wood paneling, you know, in the house, you know, the aesthetic of the era was different than the sort of dressed up version you may see now. And that's why I think kind of, I guess, Stranger Things, those guys, you know, kind of did get it right. You know, yeah, you don't see shows like that now. If you do, there's sort of a cliche, you know, version.
Yeah, and I think there's certainly not an interest by the networks for it. And then I think, you know, TV writing, you know, you pretty quickly, you're into another class where that becomes a distant memory, you know, if you're lucky. And, you know, my least favorite sitcom storyline that every sitcom has done is the stress to get your kids into the right preschool. because that's a very rich LA person fucking problem. Yeah. And I'm like, 95% of most people who have kids, their concern isn't, oh my God, they're not going to get into the right private preschool. And yet it's in every single storyline because it's a thing that like rich West Side comedy writers have sort of dealt with. And they're like, this is universal, right? You know, one kid and you getting your kid in a country day. Hate it.
Yeah. Now, the next question I got, like, if you're going to be on an exotic island, you actually want to be on, it's kind of like a resort, but no streaming. You can, you know, you want to listen to music, you can bring one CD. You want to watch a movie, you got to bring one DVD. So one CD, one DVD. That's the only thing you can watch and listen to for the entire year that you're on the island. What would that CD and DVD be for you?
I'm gonna for CD,
and I'll accept box set if you have, you know, if you want to see a box set, we'll go with that.
There's a album by Brian Eno when he was still doing glam rock in the early 70s called Here Come the Warm Jets, and it's I listened to it. You know, Brian Eno got into like sort of, you know, producing and you know, gotten a little electronic, sort of atmospheric, you know, sort of stuff. He like worked for a long time in sort of like almost like experimental, like atonal stuff. And so this is a glam rock album that has like elements of avant-garde, you know, composing, and is kind of challenging while also being incredibly poppy at the same time. And so I actually listen to it before I start any big project, because I find it inspiring how difficult and comfortable it is at the same time to listen to. And so I always find new work with it. And I think, you know, it's something I could listen to over and over again and still find new things in. And for movies, I'm going to slightly, it still think it counts, it answers the question for DVD, but it's also music. It would be Stop Making Sense by the Talking Heads. And I know this for a fact would be the DVD, because at both video store jobs I had, you had to put a movie on, you know, you had to put a movie, you know, you always had to have a movie playing on the TV. And, but I was working there. People were coming in and out and in and out. And like, sometimes you'd put in like a favorite movie that you wanted to have on the background, but even then you weren't really paying attention. And then people would sometimes ask questions, which would get annoying. And I found that the best sort of vibes in the store, best thing to work to, was to put on Stop Making Sense and in the video store. And so I've probably seen Stop Making Sense 500 times because I used to put it on the store, and it's so joyful and it's so wonderful, and you catch any 5 minutes of it and, you know, you're pumped and electrified. The place Vidiot's, I love so much. They play it like 2-3 times a year now, and it's a dance party the whole time, you know, like it's just a vibe that is fun and great music, really well shot, you know, Jonathan Demme, one of the best. And so that would be my DVD.
I love doing this because I always learn about new stuff that maybe I haven't seen before, and that's definitely one of them. Now, last couple of questions here. Perfect day. What would, from the time you get up, time you go to bed, what would be the key component parts for you of a perfect day?
Wake up, spend some time with my wife and kids. I really am entertained by both of them. Maybe we go out and do something, and I convince them to go see a movie, and we go see a movie that they really like, and then we talk about it afterwards. And then I probably then go to dinner and drinks with my wife and friends and sort of have a social night out. I'm pretty lucky in terms of, you know, in my experience, you know, part of being in a writer's room was people talk about their day and complain, and I worked with a lot of older male writers who would just bitch about their families. And, you know, I am the complete opposite. I really, really love being with my kids, and I'm entertained thoroughly by my wife every day. So my job is to sort of keep what we have going as best I can, because it's working for all of us.
That's awesome. I'm the same way with my kids. I'm like, people talk about the kids with an annoyance. I'm like, man, that's pure. They're always been, don't get me wrong, they're still kids. Things come up, but it's always joy. Next question. If you weren't doing this for a living, if somebody said writing and producing, and none of this is available to you anymore, what would be the number two? What would be the next thing you go, you know, I want to do this as a gig?
I think teaching, you know, I like teaching. I liked when I was a student, I liked, I had teachers that had profound impact on me. One of my, you know, I loved history. I took every history class I could and took enough history classes to have like a history minor in college, even though I didn't, I studied film, but, I just loved history. So I think I would probably teach history. It's storytelling in a different form, really. But I think that, especially now, I think the internet really confuses people into living in a culture of now and ignoring mm-hmm. everything that came before. And, you know, because everything on the internet is always now. And even if it's something in the past, it's all like my daughter, you know, won't listen to anything I tell her to listen to or anything I like. But she likes Kate Bush now because Kate Bush is in Stranger Things, right? So even the things that are old have to be in a context of new, right? And I do think that, you know, teaching history is important because you start to see the cyclical nature of it. You know, it's not hard to make comparisons with 1930s Weimar Germany to not only what's happening here, but happening in a lot of, you know, countries. And like, you know, it's helpful to see the patterns, because to understand them, to, you know, to try to change them, it's just helpful to know what happened in the past and how human beings are, you know, are prone to make the same mistakes.
Human nature is human nature. We're hard-coded in many ways, you know. So it's history and civics, I think, is it may be boring when you're in school sometimes, but you need somebody to kind of electrify the kids and go, you know what? And you can give examples and draw up comparisons. Then, you know, the moment we're living in now has me remembering a lot of stuff I learned in ninth grade, you know, without a doubt. Now, the last question I got, if you had that DeLorean and you could jump in it and head back to when you were 16 years old, you got a couple minutes with you as a young guy, what piece of advice would you offer up to yourself to make that moment a little bit better or to put yourself maybe a little different path? But what would you offer to, you know, 16-year-old you?
I think I would just let him know that, like, we're doing a version of what we always wanted to do. I think there was a feeling when I was that age, you know, I was certainly the kid in high school that everybody was like, you're going to become some kind of director or something, right? And, you know, I was like the movie kid, right? And so that's what everyone knew me for. But it was also like, you know, there's lots of people who wanted to do things, you know, in the entertainment industry that worked at video stores and then never did shit, right? And so the fear was I was going to be that guy. And I think just the reassurance of like, that I'm not, you know, that I'm one of the people that has made a living of this and that I've worked with great people and that I've made work that I'm extremely proud of that felt unique and special. And that it's still hard, but that, you know, it's not, you know, the interests that the 16-year-old me had is the life that I'm living now. I would probably try to be, if I was honest, I'd probably try to help him out with girls a little more than anything else. and have some things, you know, I could say to him to help him navigate his love life a little more successfully.
Well, my friend, again, thank you. This is fun. And I'm kind of making my way through Going Dutch right now. So, you know, thanks to streaming, I can catch up on that. And I want to go see that last season of Brockmeyer. That sounds quite interesting.
It's on Netflix.
It sounds really relevant.
It's, very relevant. I'm happy with how well it's aging, you know, unfortunately for the country, but I'm happy that people are still finding stuff in it.
That will be my weekend watch coming up. But my friend, I appreciate it. Go have yourself a great rest of your week, and hopefully we'll catch up down the line.
All right. Thank you so much, sir.
Okay, there you go. Joel Church Cooper. Enjoyed the conversation. Deep dive, talking how TV gets made. The show you can check out right now on Fox is Going Dutch with Dennis Leary. Highly recommend also go to Netflix. Check out Brockmire if you haven't done so already. Don't forget to go follow Story and Craft on whatever podcast platform you prefer, but make sure to check out storyandcraftpod.com. Everything about the show is right there, past episodes, past guests, but also don't forget that you can check out the show on storyandcraft.substack.com. Big fan of Substack, big fan of independent media. I really like the way it's wired up. Every time a new episode comes out, you get an email, get a notification on your app. Got that, got the website, and got your podcast app. So follow. It helps folks to find Story and Craft, and I greatly appreciate your support more than you know. You know, I'm going to jump on out of here at dinner time. My youngest Emma is in town. She's bartending at a beach bar because down here on South Padre Island in Texas, it's spring break. It's a little nuts. I'm going to go and watch this melee. As I always say, thank you very much for making whatever I got going on here part of what you've got going on. It does mean a lot to me. Going to be back soon with another episode, and I invite you back to check it out. And thanks so much, and we'll get together next time for another episode of Story and Craft. We'll talk to you then.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story.
History is full of bizarre, unsolved mysteries. And over time, these stories have been bent by rumor, warped by social media, and twisted into legend. I'm Michael May, and on A Study of Strange, we dig into these real mysteries and seek the truth, as close as we can get anyway. Recently, we've covered true crime cases like the Greystone Mansion murder, the Red Lipstick Killer, and America's first reported serial killers. Of course, every now and then we also dive into the odd, esoteric, and paranormal, including vanishing people, haunted locations, and UFO history. So if you like your mysteries historical, or if you love a good debunking every now and then, search A Study of Strange wherever you listen to podcasts. And remember, the truth is always stranger than fiction.